So hello and welcome to the program. Today we'll be talking about deep integration. Deep integration is the harmonization, not necessarily a benign concept, of Canada, the US, and Mexico's economic, political, and social arrangements. A step up from NAFTA, which is already in place, deep integration proposes to make Canadian policy akin to that of its southern neighbors. Deep integration is the dismantling of the border between Canada and the United States, says the Council of Canadians. It will affect everything. Championed by organizations in both countries that represent the interests of big business, deep integration has been nicknamed NAFTA++ and NAFTA on steroids. Here to talk to us about the inner workings of deep integration, and later on in the program, Canada's role in Afghanistan, is Victoria Gibb Carlsley, Director of Communications, Campaigns and Communications with the Council of Canadians. Founded in 1985, the Council of Canadians is Canada's largest citizens organization, with members and chapters across the country. In their blurb, they write, which is available on the internet, they write, "We work to protect Canadian independence by promoting progressive policies on fair trade, clean water, safe food, public health care, and other issues of social and economic concern to Canadians. The Council was first founded to fight Canada-US free trade, and has spent the last 20 years documenting its negative effects while working with partners in Canada and around the world to prove that that a better Canada and a better world is possible." Victoria Gibb Carlsley, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
So I'd like to begin with the question of what exactly is deep integration and how does it differ from NAFTA, which is already in place? And if you could just kind of give us a brief synopsis of what NAFTA is.
Sure. Well, I mean, NAFTA is an economic arrangement between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And the proponents of NAFTA basically said, the Canadian proponents of NAFTA said that it would level the playing field in terms of trade and also give Canadian industry market access to the United States and then to Mexico. And what we're seeing, I mean, if you think about the softwood lumber negotiated settlement that Harper has just proposed, and it certainly hasn't gone over very well, clearly NAFTA isn't working. It's not giving access to the markets it was planned. It has, in fact, caused a dumbing down of social policies in Canada, of environmental policies. Wages have stagnated in Canada since NAFTA was signed. And we are not seeing the fruits that were promised to us by NAFTA or for NAFTA by the people who negotiated it and promoted it. And so the Council of Canadians, as you said in your intro, has been monitoring the effects of first the Free Trade Agreement and then NAFTA for several years now. And I think that it's interesting that we have all along been saying that the deal was a bad one for Canada, and now you even have people like, you know, Pat Carney and others who negotiated the deal saying that it isn't working. And yet you have people like Stephen Harper trying to push for this NAFTA Plus, as you called it, which is basically, in our estimation, they've realized that NAFTA hasn't gotten them the market access that they think that they should have. And when I say they, I mean big business. And so now what they're doing is they're saying, well, if we give a little bit more to the United States, if we harmonize things more, if we make it easier by dumbing down our regulations and standards so that they match that of the United States, then we will have market access, because NAFTA didn't give us quite what we wanted. So now we'll basically, you know, give even more to try and get the market access that we've been after. And what we're saying is that deep integration, or continental integration, as some people call it, is going to sacrifice even further our social programs, our health care, our environmental standards, our food and drug safety standards, and obviously our ability to make independent policy decisions in terms of domestic policy and foreign policy.
So how did these ideas come about? How did the understanding that we need to harmonize our policies with the United States to an even greater extent, how did this come about?
Well, I mean, it's been a long time coming, and you have organizations like the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, which represents the top 150 corporations in Canada, who've been pushing this, along with groups like the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations and the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations and other business lobby groups in the United States and Mexico, who have been pushing this idea for some long time. And in fact, they got together something called the Task Force on the Future of North America. And came up with something called the North American Security and Prosperity Agenda. It was actually in 2003 that they launched this North American Security and Prosperity Agenda, and then they've been meeting since and came out with a document just after the Paul Martin signed this North American Security and Prosperity Partnership, which sounds an awful lot like the North American Security and Prosperity Agenda in both its title and its content. And so basically what you have is you have a group of business leaders with some politicians mixed in, or former politicians like John Manley is on the task force, getting together and talking about how they can harmonize standards between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico to make things better for business, and then putting forward this proposal to the Canadian government, and lo and behold, months later, the Canada, U.S., and Mexican governments come up with this partnership that has pretty much the same title and all the recommendations that this task force made. And so you have business driving the agenda. It's very clear. And at the recent meeting in Mexico, that in Cancun, Mexico, that Harper and Fox and Bush were at, you see a very blatant form of business being given free rein in terms of influencing the government, because, first of all, each of the three leaders of the countries brought five CEOs with them down to Mexico to negotiate sort of cheek to jowl with the politicians there and the bureaucrats there. So you had business leaders sitting at the table with people who are supposed to be representing the interests of all Canadians, nobody invited, you know, civil society groups, environmental groups, groups like the Council of Canadians, labor groups down there. It was business leaders who were invited down there. And then out of the meeting in Cancun came a new initiative called the North American Competitiveness Council, which is basically an organization of business leaders. It's been mandated to meet, it's been formed, and ministers of the three governments have been mandated to meet with these business leaders in between summits to put forward recommendations and hammer out policy ideas and that sort of thing. So you basically have business leaders pushing the agenda that is going to affect all of us, and average Canadians have no say in it. There's been zero parliamentary debate about this, and there has been zero public debate about it, and yet it's being driven forward. So basically you have business driving the agenda from the get-go and government just following along.
So could you maybe just outline some of the concrete specific concerns that the Council of Canadian has about this harmonization? What are the specific things that the partnership that you've been talking about will affect?
Well, there are so many, but the things that we've been really zeroing in on is our concern around Canadian water and energy resources, because under NAFTA, through the proportional sharing clause of NAFTA, basically we have this agreement with the United States through NAFTA that we cannot change the proportion of oil and gas that we export to the United States. It means that even if we run out of oil or have to cut back on supplies in Canada because, you know, oil is getting in short supply, we have to continue sort of sharing the same proportion of oil with the United States that we do now, and that's about 70% of our oil and gas. It goes to the United States. The deep integration agenda would push that even further, so it would take away even greater control from Canada in terms of our energy resources. And we have the same concern around water, that the American Southwest is very thirsty, and water sources, because of mismanagement and overuse, are drying up, and certainly Canada is seen to be a water-rich nation. And in leaked minutes that we got from the task force on the future of North America, they said that basically no item, including Canadian water, is off the table. It will simply require more time to ripen politically. So they know that if they start talking about, you know, sending Canadian water south to the U.S. right now, people are not going to be very pleased, but they're going to kind of, I'm sure, work on it from various angles. And in a few years, we wouldn't be surprised at all if we saw that there was a water-sharing agreement with the U.S. Where water would be, you know, bought or sold or traded or whatever, commodified in some way, which would mean that those who really need it wouldn't get it, and the golf courses in Arizona would be looking sweet. So, I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but that's the basic principle. So that's a concern. We have a concern around healthcare as well. Now, it's mostly being driven by, you know, the privatization of healthcare in Canada right now, but once Canada opens the door to private healthcare, as it's starting to do piecemeal, U.S. corporations can move into Canada and set up their, you know, health management organizations.
You know, how does that work exactly? How does the increased privatization within Canada allow the United States to come into our country?
Because under NAFTA, there's an exemption for healthcare that's completely publicly funded, but as soon as part of the system is privatized, then the exemption under NAFTA no longer applies. So it means that a U.S. corporation could then legally and under NAFTA rules set up shop in Canada, and it couldn't really be contested, because the reason that the Canadian healthcare system is exempt right now is because it's fully publicly funded and fully publicly delivered. Now, there has been some privatization, and no U.S. company has actually tried to come in yet, because I think that they know that the political ground isn't, they'd get a lot of resistance politically from the Canadian public. But as more and more pieces of our healthcare system are privatized and Canadians sort of get used to it, I don't know if you saw the most recent Maclean's magazine, but it's like, you know, 101 ways to access private healthcare in Canada. Quite disturbing. Anyhow, the more private healthcare there is, and the more Canadians get used to private healthcare, then, you know, there'll be that sort of opening, and certainly the legal openings there under NAFTA, and with continental integration, it would, you know, put a wedge in there even further to make it even more viable for U.S. corporations to set up shop here, and hence we worry about the Americanization of the healthcare system. So that's another piece of it.
The interview with Victoria Gibb Carsley was interrupted at this point for technical reasons. We pick up the interview again when I ask Victoria about the C.D. Howe Institute's Big Idea, one of the founding documents for the deep integration or continental integration of Canada and the U.S. I ask her how deep integration has affected our domestic security and how it is related to the events of September 11th.
So, In April 2002, the C.D. Howe Institute launched what they call the Big Idea in a report written by Wendy Dobson called Shaping the Future of North American Economic Space, a Framework for Action. And in this report, they argued that Canada should entice the U.S. government into deeper economic integration by offering full cooperation with the War on Terror, more control over Canada's energy resources, which you've talked about, uh-huh. and the possibility of greater access to Canadian water, which you've also talked about. And which are your two major concerns in the Council of Canadians. Now, I was wondering how exactly this deep integration tied into Canadian-U.S. security concerns, and especially in light of this coming out post 9/11, how does it tie into 9/11?
Yeah. Okay. So what I think is that basically, you know, the 9/11 provided an opportunity. And unfortunately, we feel it was exploited. It was a tragic and terrible event, but it was exploited by business interests and by military interests to use the line that they like, which is security trumps trade. And so what has happened is I think that there has been this pressure placed on Canada by the U.S. and by Canadian business interests to align ourselves more closely militarily and security-wise with the United States so that we could assure market access. Because, of course, the border was closed very briefly after 9/11, and of course the U.S. is using this, you know, we don't want your terrorists in here and across the border from Canada. And so this idea that if you want to have this open border for goods, then you must have we must have some agreement around security provisions. And so hence this, you know, in Cancun, Mexico, the end of last month when the three leaders met, this whole idea of smart cards came up where Canadians are now going to have to either have a passport or even more scary, I think, a smart card that has biometric information on it in order to get across the border into the United States. And our concern around that is that under the USA Patriot Act, which is also a product of 9/11, that information on your biometric smart card could be shared with the FBI in the United States without you knowing it, or other security agencies, you know, with your, no knowledge of the individuals that their information is being shared with these agencies. So you have things like this happening. You have, and I know we'll talk about Afghanistan in a bit, but you have Canada starting to align itself with the U.S. militarily as well in terms of how we speak. The appointment of General Hillier as somebody who spent a lot of time in the U.S., he spent some time actually commanding U.S. forces in an exchange program with the Canadian military. He's very much a U.S.-style general, and he's now the head of the Canadian forces. And you've got, of course, Canadians in Afghanistan fighting under basically the command of a U.S. operation called Operation Enduring Freedom. And so you have us, Prime Minister Martin said no to missile defense because he knew it would be political suicide not to. And we said no to the war in Iraq. But there are a lot of ways that our Canadian military is lining itself up very neatly with the U.S. And it's a big concern for us. And never mind, you know, the fact that for immigrants and refugees who are being targeted because of their ethnicity or skin color at the border, where human rights abuses are you know, a big issue. And the Council of Canadians intervened on the Maher Arar case, and everybody knows about that, in terms of his you know, deportation by U.S. officials to Syria, where he was tortured. So you've got a lot of things going on in terms of security and military action that we are looking less and less like peacekeepers and more like war makers in Canada. And it's a direct result, I think, of the exploitation of 9/11.
We've been talking with Victoria Gibb Carlsley of the Council of Canadians, the Director of Campaigns and Communications. Right now, we're going to turn to Afghanistan. So, Victoria, Canada's role in Afghanistan has been described, on the one hand, by Chief of Defense Staff General Rick Hillier as, quote, our job is to be able to kill people, and on the other hand, by former Foreign Affairs Minister Bill Graham as the reconstruction of a failed state. Now, so these are the two things I'd like you to talk about.
Well, first of all, in terms of Rick Hillier's comments about our job is to kill people, I mean, sadly, that is, I mean, soldiers are trained to kill people. That is their job when it comes to a war, when you're, you know, defending your country or whatever. Canada has traditionally been a peacekeeper, and I think it's a role that Canadians have been very proud of, that we've been peacekeepers. I think that it was fewer than 10 years ago, I think 9 out of every $10 was spent on peacekeeping missions in Canada, and now I think it's less than $1 for every $10 that's spent on peacekeeping missions in Canada. I mean, there's been this radical shift since NAFTA, actually, of spending of how we spend our military dollars. And in terms of our role in Afghanistan, interestingly, Hillier, I think, was appointed in something like January 2005, and I think he sort of jumped queue a little bit. I don't think he was next in line to be the head of the armed forces, but he did become head of the armed forces with a very distinctive, you know, personality and orientation to go with that. And then it was in May in 2005 the decision was made by the Defense Committee to move our troops from Kabul to Kandahar, where they became, instead of under NATO control, they became under the command, basically, of this U.S.-led Operation Enduring Freedom. So we went from sort of going to Afghanistan. I think the public generally thought that we were not we were going to Afghanistan to do peacekeeping and rebuilding and the stuff that, you know, the Canadian military has traditionally seen to do, and move to basically being part of supporting Bush's war on terror. And that's what we're doing in Afghanistan right now. And I don't know if you asked the average Canadian in the street what we're doing in Afghanistan, why are our troops there, if they would actually know that we're under U.S. command there and we are fighting the war on terror. Because I don't think that George Bush's war on terror is terribly popular in Canada. So So I think most Canadians would be a bit startled to know that that's in fact what we are doing over there. And so this shift, again, it's again no public debate, no, there was, when this a decision was made in May 2005, you'll remember it was the whole fiasco when Belinda Stronach was crossing the floor and the government was teetering and stuff, so the focus was not at all on what was happening militarily in Afghanistan. It was on domestic issues. And so this change of sending our troops south to Kandahar, I think it's south, was not even really noticed in what the reasons were and what it actually meant. And what, of course, it means, very tragically, is increased fatalities, increased injuries in our troops, and that we're participating in this U.S.-led endeavor. So we have a real concern about the fact that our troops are not doing peacekeeping work. They're fighting the war on terror. And they're fighting the war on terror on behalf of the United States Army. I think that, again, the feeling is that if we support the U.S. and its military endeavors, that they will, you know, it will be good for business in the long run. It will be very good for military business, but it will be good, you know, generally overall, Canada will, or the U.S. will, you know, look favorably to Canada, and market access will be ensured. Everything that NAFTA was supposed to give us, but we're sort of having to give over more and more of our power in order to get this economic benefit back. And it's not us who get the benefit, right? It's the CEOs and shareholders of the very large corporations who are pushing this agenda. And Canadians and Canadians who have their sons and daughters overseas in Afghanistan are, you know, are the ones who are suffering. So it's... It really is something that, I mean, we think that there should be a vote on Afghanistan in the House. There was another debate, but it was quite sad because really very few parliamentarians showed up, and there wasn't a vote. It was just a take-note debate, and so, you know, we feel that this is an issue that's important enough that there really should be a vote.
So just closing up here, we're running out of time. Maybe.
Sure.
You have maybe a minute left. How long do you think Canada is going to be in Afghanistan?
Sadly, I think Canada is going to be in Afghanistan as long as the U.S. wants us to be in Afghanistan, unless the Canadian public really stands up and says we will not abide this. I think that there is a renewal. I think it's February of next year where they have to make a decision about whether they're going to renew the mission. The government has to make a decision about whether they're going to renew the mission in Afghanistan, and so it's very important that there's a lot of public mobilization around it before then. And if people, you know, want to know more about what the Council of Canadians does, they can go to www.canadians.org. There's also ceasefire.ca, which is a very good organization working on issues of you know, Afghanistan, and the Council of Canadians is more broadly on deep integration issues. So, but let's hope that the public stands up and, you know, says this is not where we want our troops to be.
So we've been talking with Victoria Gibb-Cosley of the Council of Canadians, and Victoria, thank you for being on the show today.
You are most welcome.
Okay.